Hi, and welcome to episode number 150 of the weekly Google Cloud Platform podcast. I'm Mark Mandel, and I'm here, as always, with my colleague Melanie. How are you doing, Melanie?
Hi, Mark. I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well.
What episode is this?
This is 150.
150. I know. It's amazing, right?
I know. I was actually trying to work out when you first came on the podcast and I couldn't work it out.
I started helping you at the beginning of November. So we're almost at a year.
We're almost at a year. That's pretty good. Yeah. You put up with me for a year.
I know. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
And it's been almost 3 years since you started the podcast.
It's true. Your first episode you came on was 93. What's AI with Melanie Warwick?
True. Y'all did interview me, but I actually started helping you in November when Francesc took off. Anyway, so Mark, what do we have for this week?
So we have some cool stuff for this week. We have a very good mutual friend of ours, KF, who has a long history of working in the software engineering industry, doing distributed systems and kind of all the things, I feel like, and is the reason we know each other in the first place as well.
Exactly. She is definitely the reason we know each other. And it's an interview that I've been wanting us to do for a while now. So I'm really glad we finally got a chance to talk to her. And we were able to do that actually at a conference where we did meet also, which is Strange Loop, a great conference that's out of St. Louis. So we'll get into that in the interview. But yeah, I'm glad we finally got a chance to get her on here.
Yeah, exactly. And so after we talk to her, we will have our question of the week as we do always, which is, how do I encrypt and decrypt data with cloud key management services? Which is something I've not looked at before, but it's actually kind of cool.
Definitely. And as we always do, we're going to start out with cool things of the week. And for this week, we've got a lot of support and integration going on with PyTorch, which is a platform that's used for building out neural nets. Similar to TensorFlow, it's just a different platform. And so PyTorch, we now have integrated. So there's actually on Google Cloud Platform, you know, deep learning VM images that you can implement. It's also been integrated already in Kubeflow, but there's additional support specifically because PyTorch has also launched 1.0. So you can use that on GCP, you can use it with Kubeflow, you can use it actually also with TensorBoard. And there's work in progress. They're piloting some stuff around the cloud TPUs and using PyTorch. So we'll post the article for that and you can check it out.
Nice. Since we're talking about Kubeflow and Kubernetes, we'll want to mention a wonderful little article called A Developer On-Ramp to Kubernetes with GKE. I thought this was really nice in that it's a set of tools specifically for making it easier and more affordable to run small Kubernetes clusters, basically up to four nodes or less than four nodes if you want. So if you're trying to set up a small developer environment, we actually have some documentation and a developer template set up, as well as a new open source utility called Kubehost to get around some of the cost things that happen with Kubernetes. It can be a little bit more expensive if you want to run a big cluster. So this is just some nice tooling to get you started in a nice low cost way.
And another cool thing of the week we want to mention is network controls in GCP versus on-premises. This is a blog post that our friend Grace has posted
in
conjunction with Jens Kuhlers, which I'm probably botching the name. But this article in particular is sort of walking you through the fact that the network controls in GCP are not that different necessarily from on-premises, so you wouldn't have to do a significant amount of additional understanding, I guess, or work to understand the two. And they talk through like subnets and routes and firewalls and VPN.
Yeah. And last, definitely not least, I feel like every time we turn around, there's a new article by our teammate, Sarah Robinson. I don't know if that's the way you feel.
I do too. She's definitely producing a lot of good content.
Yeah,
on
it's really great. Absolutely. So she has another great article talking about AutoML, but in this case, it's talking about AutoML Translate, which is really kind of interesting. It talks about how and why you might need AutoML power translate capabilities. So the example that they use is, like, for example, using the word driver. Like if you're playing golf, driver means one thing, but if you need a taxi, driver means something else. But if you're in a software context, driver means yet another thing. And so you might need something like AutoML to be able to do translations that are domain specific.
Yes. And she steps you through an example that she's built out specifically with AutoML Translate and also using something known as WeLocalize, which is one of the largest localization providers in the US with a mission to help the customers localize content for global audiences. So you can check out her article and see how to use Google AutoML Translate.
Awesome. Well, why don't we go have a chat with KF?
Yes, we should definitely go talk with KF.
It'll be fun.
I'm very happy we have with us today KF, who is a good friend of both of ours, and this is the reason why Mark and I actually know each other.
Yes.
So KF, thank you very much for coming on the podcast today.
Sure. Hi.
Hi.
Hey.
So KF, tell us a little bit about who you are.
Yeah, what do you do?
Why do we know you?
Yeah. I do computers vaguely.
Excellent.
I do some combination of like back end and data and infrastructure things. primarily at startups.
And data science things.
I would not describe myself as a data scientist.
That's fair.
I would describe myself as an engineer with a math degree.
We were noting before we started recording, you did hold the title at one point of data scientist.
I'm not sure that startup titles count.
This is a good way to get started. So we're recording this at Strange Loop. Strange Loop is this conference is actually where I met Mark because of KF. And I met KF because we both went through the same coding boot camp, not together, but we met because of it, which was really great.
Oh, you went through it different times. I did not know that.
But anyway, so KF, how's the conference going for you?
It's good. It is mostly, this is my sixth year coming, so every time I come back, it's like fewer and fewer talks I go to at the conference and more just sort of walking around attempting to go to a talk as people stop me on the way.
And actually, what is Strange Loop?
I don't really know. I think when I started coming, it was mostly because there were talks on functional programming, and that is not necessarily the talks I go to now at all.
I feel like it's like this weird mix of bleeding edge-ish computer science, wacky, interesting tech stuff, philosophy, diversity, inclusion, social, political issues mushed into one big thing that seems like it's cool and interesting.
Yeah, and it's been going on for 10 years. Alex, who's the original person who drove and developed all this, he's doing a little retrospective back on when it started. I think it was like 300 people with the first one, and now it's like around 2,200 people for this one. Yeah, based in St. Louis. So you don't know, but you love it, and you got a good network here. What were some of the highlights from today and yesterday so far for you?
I spent most of the past day and a half going to talks about tech related to social good, which is not something that they had talks on whenever I first started coming. Mm-hmm. It was more in like recent years, given the political atmosphere, that these started being introduced. So Bridget, who's one of the other organizers, who I know from doing closure stuff, she put together a pre-conference day that was the whole day yesterday that was on like people who work on tools related to like nonprofits and helping the government and environmental issues and things like that. So,
any cool stuff that we could take away and potentially tell our listeners?
I think the most actionable talk was probably the one from the guy who started Ruby for Good.
Oh, cool.
Gave a talk about how to get more involved with like nonprofits and why you should do that.
Nice.
In your spare time, like instead of just doing open source related to things that are technically interesting, doing open source related to things that are useful to people outside of the tech industry.
You went to that talk. Oh, never mind.
I wasn't here yesterday.
In spirit, not physically. No.
You went to a different talk on open source. That was today.
I did. Evan, who started Elm, whose last name I can never pronounce, did a really interesting talk on dealing with being an open source maintainer and dealing with like people coming up and being like, Elm is going to die. And like, how do you handle that as an open source maintainer? But also like actions that can be taken to potentially turn that into a more positive statement and like codify the sort of conversations that should happen inside that environment. And he tied it back to a whole bunch of like philosophical and sociological stuff that came previously with like books about that kind of stuff that come from like the 60s and stuff. It was actually a really, really good talk.
Nice. Mark, what got you starting to come to Strange Loop?
I used to come here from Australia regularly, I think about 6 years ago.
Wow. So you've been here for 6 years as well?
Something like that. I think I missed a year somewhere in between. I'm trying to remember. I think I had a friend who was coming or I saw it and I was like, that just looks awesome. And I need to be at that conference. And so I started. I think it was a short answer. And then I was like, this is amazing. I need to come back. It's a conference that imposes imposter syndrome.
Like it that's really inspiring for people to come.
Yeah, I know. But I feel like it's true because it is an environment in which you're always going to meet someone who knows stuff you don't know, or you're just going to sit in a talk and just be like, I have no idea what that is. But I feel like 2 years down the line, if you head in a certain direction, depending on what it is, you'll be like, oh, I remember that talk from Strange Loop 2 years ago that I saw about someone talking about something. Now I know how to make like mathematical models that'll tell me how to fold origami paper. Like, awesome. I can use that.
And did you make that?
I have not needed that yet, but I assume at some point that I will.
Someday you will. Okay, well, if it's imposing the imposter syndrome, why are you both coming back so often?
I don't know that I have imposter syndrome. I think I tend to see working in the tech industry as being like in many other jobs in which you just have to constantly pick up new skills because capitalism.
Yep. I also love to learn. That's a big, deep-seated like thing that I love, the passion. So
I know. I appreciate that this conference seems to be very driven to give conference talks on knowledge and sharing knowledge versus like we want to show you the new.
Yeah, it's very much not a beginner conference, but I think it's still open to people who have beginners, either levels or mindsets.
Yes. Maybe whenever I started coming, I had like no experience programming.
Yeah. Wait, is that like realistically or functionally?
No, like realistically, I had no experience programming. I had like 3 months of experience programming or something ridiculous.
Yeah, I'd never done functional programming before or touched like anything that had been mentioned at Strange Loop before I came.
And the first year I came, it was before they had like opportunity grants and things.
Okay. Which is one of the things I've always been very impressed with this conference in particular. There's been such a drive specifically with opportunity grants and just making sure that the diversity is being recognized and built out. And if anything, I've seen that evolve and change. It's such a small thing, but it's so true. Like last year was the first time I saw a line at the women's bathroom, and it was the first time I've ever seen a line at the women's bathroom. I was like, oh, that's awesome. Any other highlights from the conference this year, previous years? Like, did y'all meet at this conference?
How did we meet?
We met through our mutual friend, Sean, who you know from when you did Cold Fusion.
That sounds about right. That sounds about right, actually.
And who I know through things unrelated to Cold Fusion.
You weren't a Cold Fusion programmer too? Actually, to your point, like we were talking about like why I was here, I feel like, and if we want to go back through my history, because I don't know why, that seems like a thing we're doing now. I think it was around the time that I'd stopped kind of doing Cold Fusion as a thing and was really trying to expand my horizons and learn a whole bunch of stuff. And Strange Loop looked like an amazing opportunity to do that, and honestly continues to be so.
Did Strange Loop inspire you to get more exposure to distributed systems, distributed computing?
I think it sort of came the other way around, which is I got into programming because I was in grad school for math. And for some assignment, my first semester of grad school, I ended up reading research papers from like the Google research website. And was reading something about like clustering algorithms at YouTube or something and was like, oh, this is interesting. And then tried to like learn to program and stuff and then ended up going to code school. And then once I was there, people were like, you seem to be the kind of person who enjoys academic papers, which means probably functional programming and distributed systems are for you.
And then you went with it.
Yeah. Not necessarily a normal start into programming.
What is a normal start into programming?
I do know that when I started out doing programming and could cite a bunch of academic papers but had no experience in industry, that was deeply unusual and people did not know how to respond to it. I think it's less bizarre now, in part, I think, because they have things like Strange Loop that have opportunity grants. So it's like not unheard of.
Do you recommend it as a pathway?
That's a great
recommend
question.
Recommend is a strong word. I would say like follow your bliss. Also though, I don't think it's harder from like a technical perspective to pick up these things.
Yep.
There's nothing inherent about this area of computer science or software engineering that I feel is harder than like doing front end, for example. I think that sometimes people make it artificially harder because they think it's harder, so they don't bother to sort of like learn how to talk about things in a way that's more approachable versus like, does there exist something that teaches distributed systems to beginners in a systematic way, like the way that there's Girls Who Code and what are the nonprofit? Like,
yeah,
there are so many though at this point where they teach. There are so many places where you can, yes, the variety of all these like workshops.
You can learn how to
series.
Build a website. You can learn how to build a machine learning application. You haven't seen anything yet that's been like introductory to.
No, I don't think people see it as being introductory at all. In part because nobody writes introductory materials.
Where does distributed computing typically sit within the structure of an engineering org from what you've seen and what you've experienced?
I tend to get bounced around between back-end infrastructure platform type teams. And then I sort of fell into doing data things for a few years, like off and on, because a lot of the languages that I was using to do platform type stuff were also starting to get used for data stuff. So like Scala originally I picked up not for data stuff. I picked it up primarily because like functional programming and distributed systems. And then that started becoming a language because of Spark that people were using for data. So then people looked at my resume and were like, you do data things because you have a math degree and know these languages, which is like not necessarily accurate, though it is now.
It's kind of how it works in general. But I remember at one point you also you've had a passion for Clojure in terms of the functional programming space.
With I know that's J. Yes. Just making sure that's clear.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. So I fell into doing closure not for work, but because I was on a mailing list and Bridget, who's now one of the co-organizers for Strange Loop, was putting together workshops to teach women closure and or functional programming through closure. And before I worked in tech, I worked in teaching. So I was sort of like, if you needed any help with curriculum development, let me know. And then I got involved with it through that. And then eventually, despite the fact that I had not written like almost any closure in earnest, yeah. I just became very strongly associated with it until it was actually a thing that I did.
So I also want to know, I'm very curious about this answer actually. We said distributed computing, like distributed systems. Like, what does that mean to you?
I think that there's a meaning that it holds for me, and then there's the meaning that it holds in industry.
And what's the, yeah, because, what is
because
that?
Because to me, like, if you're a front-end developer, you have to have ideas about distributed computing at this point. I think when you talk to people in the industry, most of the time what they mean is, like, you work on, like, core platform infrastructure type deals.
Does that mean Kubernetes?
Amongst other things, sure.
Mark really wants to bring up the Kubernetes perspective because I believe there was some stuff in the history between the two of you around Kubernetes.
When I met Mark, he was still living in Australia and did not work for Google. That's and true. Had no reason to shill Kubernetes at the time.
Right.
It wasn't even necessarily popular at the time.
And,
but he was deeply enthusiastic in a way where I was like, why don't you just like go and sell people Kubernetes as your job? And then he like became a developer relations person for Kubernetes things.
And here we are.
And here we are. But now you've actually used Kubernetes after giving me grief about it for a really long time.
Sure.
Yeah.
And what do you think
and
of Kubernetes?
And now we've come full circle.
And what do you think of Kubernetes?
I think it's a tool and it's a step in the right direction. And I think it helps build better abstractions in the long term. I tend to think about these things not necessarily from the perspective of like running infrastructure for the sake of keeping things running, but more from the idea of like infrastructure as a product. Mm-hmm. And I think that it becomes easier to build those kinds of tools when you have something like Kubernetes that becomes like an abstraction over things.
Are there any other tools that you've found are valuable in the work that you do?
I mean, there's Docker, which is just sort of like at this point also prolific after, like it wasn't when I started. And now after 5 years, it's just like, I can't imagine not using it at this point.
So I know we've talked around about the different things that you've done. What do you enjoy doing in the computing space?
I don't know that I enjoy specific technical things at this point. I enjoy building things that are useful.
That's valid. Because I think you've had kind of a history of kind of building platforms that would then be on use by other areas of companies. Would that be vaguely right?
Yeah. I haven't done as much feature development for things that get used externally. I've done some of that. When I work on those kinds of services, it's usually more from like an SRE perspective, where I'm like trying to make something more performant for the customer, not necessarily building the initial thing. So
I know you've done the coding bootcamp, you've done some of your own self-study. Like, what do you think are some good pathways now? And we've already talked about some of the new coding projects that are out there a little bit in terms of getting people in, but what do you think are some good ways for those who are trying to find their pathway into building things, whatever form that takes?
I think all of the options are hard.
Ah.
I think there was a period of time where if you already had a degree or you couldn't afford to go to college, then coding boot camps were potentially a really great option if you chose the right one. But now they've been around for so long and there are so many, I think it's hard to choose one because there are so many that are potentially bad and there's no regulation on them. If you don't have experience with software engineering, and you maybe don't know anyone who does software engineering, which is the kind of person who I think would go to a coding bootcamp, it's kind of impossible to tell whether something is snake oil or not. So I say that coding bootcamps exist and some of them are okay, and probably check course report. See if it's decent. There are like more places that are starting to do apprenticeships, which I feel like are always like the best option. If you can manage to go to school for computer science, that's sort of like always, I think, still like the best option, but that's not really realistic for everyone.
Yeah.
It wasn't realistic for me, so.
Well, actually, the keynote this morning at Strange Loop was talking about how important it is for all kids to be exposed to some type of computer science or just basically
foundational
around,
computer science,
something along those lines, as well as trying to give ideas to think outside the box. But what do you think about that in terms of the education of kids? Do you think that that's a skill that definitely needs to be applied across the board?
I think that everyone should have exposure to computer science.
Yeah.
I think some people take it to a larger degree and say like, everyone should have so many years of computer science classes or coding classes in school. Mm. I don't agree that that's like reasonable. Having worked in schools, it's like there's not enough time already to cover things. Mm. Like, what is the thing you're going to take out of the curriculum to put this in? I would struggle to think of something like a core subject if you're treating computer science as a core subject that like is less important than learning to code. I would struggle to think of something.
And one of the points they were making this morning too was how it's hard to find also teachers, specifically showing some numbers in terms of there's less teachers to be able to provide the education.
And the incentives are aligned for people with computer science degrees to not be teachers.
Right. And I was thinking at the time, I was like, you could line that up against those who have the expertise than in the machine learning space. And I'm sure it's even less people. But I guess the question I'd ask is, you've mentored a number of people coming into the space. Do you have any advice for those who might be thinking about being mentors who want to help others getting into the space?
I think the main thing is that you should try to, one, align yourself with some sort of nonprofit if you're doing it sort of systematically. There are like coding boot camps that are for profit that rely very heavily on mentors. And if the reason for mentoring people is to help get more people into the field, I don't understand the rationale for doing that at a for-profit school. In the same way that I will sometimes like go give talks at universities to college students about computer science, if I'm going to sink a bunch of my time like connecting with some sort of like organization that's providing mentorship to people, I tend to go for something that's like low cost or free, because that's usually people who need it most. Like, a lot of people I have met through like going to conferences or being involved specifically with like setting up like opportunity grant systems or volunteering around that. I don't know that this is like advice for people mentoring so much as like for people who need help with things, is like you'd be surprised how willing people are to help you if you just ask them for it. Most of the time people will say yes. Not because I asked for help, but because people ask me for help and most of the time I say yes. Or I like introduce them to someone who's more able to help them, and most of the time that person says yes.
I was going to say, like, yeah, have you got any suggestions for people to find mentors? I know that's been, that can be tricky sometimes.
Yeah.
Just ask the question.
I ask the question, but also spend some amount of time up front trying to figure out like who the person is and like what their specialty
is. So you're not saying
is.
I should just hop on LinkedIn
and spam everyone
with emails?
That's like not
that's not a thing.
It's more sort of like go to events in your area if you have them. If you don't, like every job I've gotten through Twitter. Mm. And like most of the people who I know who have spent time with me teaching me things, like a disproportionately large number of those people I met on Twitter. It's more like go socialize with people.
That's interesting.
I'm originally from Houston, so the advice of like go to events doesn't apply as strongly as in some cities as others, because there aren't as many tech events in Houston as there are even in like Portland, where I live now.
Or start up your That's own true. Event and start up your own community if you can.
That takes work, but yeah, if you've got time.
It's another way. I know I've met a number of people who've done that. And I know you and I have talked about this before, but just to be on the same page on this one, the people you've mentored especially, like not everybody has a math degree. Not everybody who's come into this space necessarily had much experience with computer science. The people that I've come across, and I know for myself too, would you say that's probably what you've seen as well?
Yeah, most of the time.
Because I know that that can sometimes be an intimidating factor, talking about the imposter syndrome before.
Yeah, it's probably worth noting, like, I mean, amongst our peers and like people I know, like, I know a variety of people who have degrees, but not even remotely in computer science, in psychology and philosophy. And like, I know people who are theater majors, right, who work in computer science.
Hey, my first degree was in English. And then I went back to school later and got a math degree.
Technically, I have a bachelor in multimedia. I don't know what that's worth at all.
Yeah. It's for making podcasts. That's what it's for.
It's so I can use Macromedia Director. That's what it's for.
That's the only reason why.
Yeah.
How did games come into the middle of this? Just because you play them.
Yeah, I play them.
So on a different note, how do you get all your work done with your cat on your head?
I work from home. My cat usually leaves me alone unless I'm in meetings, is the key
Sounds
thing.
About right.
How do you make sure you're successful in what you're doing working remotely? Because I know that's something that you typically do.
Yeah, I've always worked remotely. For a while, I worked for a company that was in Portland while I lived in Portland, but just like never went into the office. I think I started doing remote stuff like from when I was entry level on, which is unusual because most people aren't willing to hire people who are entry level to work remotely. I think it was mostly a factor of finding support systems locally, or even if not locally, like now all the time I'll like run into something and I won't really know how to solve the problem and I'll be like the tech lead, so there's no one else to solve it for me at work. Mm. So I end up going and talking to like people I just like know from the internet.
Yep.
Or people I met in other cities when I was at conferences or when I lived there, when I worked for a company there, and be like,
in your network,
have you run into this? Yeah.
Actually,
and then we do that to each other.
That's a really good question too. And just talking about remote culture and something of like you said, like people don't like to hire people who are at entry level for remote positions. Like what's a successful way of bringing in entry level people for remote positions, do you think?
I don't think it's a requirement that people have previous professional experience to work remotely as part of their first job, because I've worked with entry-level people who had never really had a job before, mm-hmm. and were remote in like other time zones, other countries, and it worked out fine. I do think though that it is helpful to like set them up with a specific person who can like walk them through
like a one-on-one
what
mentor.
That looks like. Yeah, like you should do that anyway when someone is starting a job, but like even more so with remote stuff, especially if you can find someone who's been doing remote for like a while. And it helps to be very explicit about like what your day looks like and what other people's days look like. So when I started working remotely, I did not actually have industry experience. Before that, I'd only ever worked in schools. So I did not understand what it was like to work in an office.
Right.
So I had this, I didn't understand that there were like times of the day when people went up to go get coffee or like walk down the street to get coffee even. And that was like a 20-minute break right there. So I had this like weird notion that I needed to be sitting at my computer all the time.
Oh, wow.
Or like, and I needed to put in like 8 hours a day. And I also worked freelance for a while, like 8 hours a day of like earnest coding, not like working, which
and then a now, coffee break.
Yeah, like yeah. Now I understand that working involves many things, such as like talking to people.
Right.
When I started out, I didn't understand this, and I would just anchor myself to my computer for 8 hours a day minimum and code things. And I remember coworkers would try to like encourage me to get lunch.
Right, which is a thing you should do.
You should do this.
Yes.
But also I was entry level and it was like my first office quote unquote right. job. You can't look around and see other people modeling like
yeah.
how to do things. So you have to be very explicit about like, this is how I conduct my day. You could also do it these other ways, but this is how I do it.
How do you conduct your day?
So I usually start working by 9:30, which means I get up at 9 at the earliest sometimes. And then I shower and have breakfast or whatever. I usually work from home in the morning because I don't like commuting during rush hour times.
Yep.
So unless I'm biking, I will work from home in the morning. And then I'll take lunch at around noon to 1. So I'll eat lunch and then commute into a co-working space. And then I will work from the co-working space for the rest of the afternoon and then come home whenever like about 8 hours of working has yep. been accomplished. Or until like sometimes I have a mindset that I'm in and I just like don't want to stop. So I'll keep working until I finish the thing I'm doing.
Adjust later.
Yep. Yeah. We've gone down this remote stuff, which I actually really enjoy because it's something I used to do too. I'd love to also hear about like, how do you find like good communication patterns in like remote teams? Like things tend to be asynchronous. Not everyone's awake at the same time. Do you have thoughts on like either technology or patterns or like workplace standards? I don't know.
I try to look for people who enjoy talking. When I interview, I try to see if they're like reasonably talkative, mm-hmm. if they have an online presence, that's like one way to tell if they like tend to talk a lot and stuff online. Despite working remotely for like the entire time I've worked in tech, I am not a very like insular person and I talk.
Shocked.
You're
shocked.
Like, shocking. Shocking, I know.
You might have a few tweets out there.
Yeah.
Maybe just a couple.
So I try to find workplaces where people aren't completely siloed mm-hmm. and they still talk to each other all the time throughout the day. I like comically refer to it as like when I start a new job, I'm joining a new Slack. Yeah.
And do you feel like you almost have to be more vocal in some ways being remote? You kind of have to push your personality and your communication out more than you would say if you're in an office because of the distance.
I've experienced this especially with people who are starting out and they're like relatively junior and they are working remotely for the first time or something. If you're in an office and you have a junior dev who is like struggling, you can usually tell that they're struggling because they look stressed and they haven't moved for like hours. Versus if they're remote, you have no idea unless you constantly ping them or unless they become very direct and tell you that this is happening, which is like extremely unlikely that they will do this unless you set up that rapport in advance. So, yes.
And a lot of GIFs, animated GIFs, I feel help a lot.
I use more GIFs than are reasonable.
On a more general note, what do you value most in the companies that you work for?
I try to find people who are different from me, who are sufficiently different from me that I'm not just stagnating as a person. I think a lot of people look for jobs where you're picking up a new tech stack and pushing yourself in that regard. I try to find companies where they're open to hiring junior devs, where not everyone is white, where not everyone is a man, where there are queer people, where there are people with disabilities, especially because if you hire a remote, I feel like a lot of companies miss the part about how that kind of environment can be, like, when it's set up correctly, like, give people really great job opportunities because people who are disabled are generally deeply unemployed.
Yeah.
So...
Well, so this is great. And I just wanted to say, is there anything else that you wanted to talk about around Strange Loop, around working remotely, around, you know,
Kubernetes? Do you want to talk about Kubernetes?
Where you're going to be next?
Not particularly.
That's a good answer.
Well, KF, thank you for spending time with us today. As always, spending time with you is a pleasure, but it was lovely having out recording this time.
Yes, thank you for coming on the podcast. Actually, well, one last thing. Who would you recommend should consider coming to Strange Loop?
If you're into functional programming, distributed systems, security type things, this is probably a good conference to go to. Not necessarily like you've done them or you've been doing them, but like if you were just interested in them, I think that's sufficient to come.
Let's get dinner.
Let's get dinner.
KF, thank you again for coming on the podcast. I'm so glad we were able to make that work.
Yeah, me too. Really great to have you on. Actually, I went and had a look. Melanie, you started with us in episode 102. So two more episodes and you're at 50 episodes.
Sweet. Two more and I'm done.
Yeah, you were you came on to do Smart Parking and IoT Core with Brian Grenatier. We did the wrappers together for that.
Yeah, the smart parking was a really interesting one too. I know we resurfaced that with some articles that he wrote a while back. But yes, good times, Mark. Well, so let's get into the question of the week.
Yeah.
Which is not about when did I start. We could have saved that for the audience. Anyways, for the question of the week, how do I encrypt and decrypt data with cloud key management service?
Yeah, I think this is actually really interesting. I was kind of just poking around looking for a question of the week, and I've never really looked at cloud key management service, but basically it's a cloud-hosted key management service that lets you manage cryptographic keys for your cloud. It's actually really cool. So there's a couple of post that we'll link to about basically doing encryption and decryption. I am not a security expert, so I'm going to try and read this as much as possible. But
it's like I'm not a doctor.
I'm not a doctor, exactly.
Dr. Mandel, please report to neurosurgery in OR7.
But I'm not a lawyer, none of those things. But the client APIs as well as the gCloud tools support both symmetric and asymmetric encryption. So if I get this right, symmetric algorithms use the same key for both encryption and decryption, whereas asymmetric algorithms use different keys for encryption and decryption. And there are different reasons for using one over the other. It's really quite straightforward to do the encryption and decryption. Basically, you're specifying like your location, your key ring, your key, and then you sort of specify the text you want to encrypt. It kind of spits it back. And then to decrypt it, it's basically doing the same thing all over again. And all of those keys are managed by Cloud Key Management Service, which is kind of neat.
Yes.
And very similarly for Yeah, the RSA, the asynchronous one. Asymmetric words are hard.
Some days encryption. They are.
And there's also examples there for different languages as well. Go, Java, Python for the asymmetric, and like C#, Go, Java, Node.js, Python, Ruby, PHP.
Or just from your command line.
Yeah, you can do it too. It's actually really straightforward. I was super impressed.
Great. Well, Mark, where are you going to be in the next couple weeks, next couple months? What are you excited about?
That is a really good question. I don't think I'm going anywhere special for the next month, which is super nice. Really kind of happy. It looked like I was going to go Unitely, and then I wasn't, and then I wasn't. It doesn't look like I'm going, so it's a little sad, but I'm sure plenty of Google Cloud people there, they're going to have a great time. I think I'm just excited to be going to KubeCon in December.
Great. Well,
what about yourself?
This week, I will be at Chemlis in Washington, D.C., which is a security and data conference, and I'm looking forward to that.
Nice. Well, yeah, actually, the thing that I will be doing as well is I'll be getting back into doing some more Twitch streaming of various things. Lots of fun.
Have you not been doing that?
I took a break in September because I was traveling so much.
I was going to say, clearly I'm not watching.
But yeah, it'll be good to get back to that.
Oh, well, good. I'm glad. When is that?
Usually I do that at 9 a.m. Pacific on Tuesdays, but I'm going to try and slot in doing some more streams in the middle of the week. Follow me on Twitter and Twitch for more details.
And then, Mark, if people want to get in touch with us or subscribe to the podcast. Oh,
yes, that's good. We haven't done this in a while. So if you want to subscribe to the podcast, everything can be found at gcppodcast.com. You can find our RSS feeds, the iTunes links, you can find Stitcher, YouTube, all the stuff that's on there.
Email us at hello@gcppodcast.com.
Yeah, if you want to send us questions of the week, we actually have a form on the bottom of the new website. So if you want to check that out, I mean, you can send us emails too, love emails, or hit us up on G+ or hit us up on Reddit. Our G+ account is +GCPPodcast. Our Reddit is /r/GCPPodcast.
And we are GCPPodcast on Twitter.
Yep, exactly. But yeah, if you go to the website and you go all the way down the bottom, on the bottom left-hand side in the footer, there's a form. You can go there and you can drop in questions of the week. And we check it out every week to see what questions people are giving us.
What's on people's minds. Great. I think that's it for us for this week, Mark.
Yeah. So, Melanie, thanks for joining me for yet another week on the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you all for listening. And we'll see you all next week.